Exploration with Dr. Mishu Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And first, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science, including the fact that a gigantic tent is now being built over Unit 1 at the Fukushima nuclear disaster site, a gigantic plastic tent that hopefully will contain some of the radiation that continues to seep out of the reactor. And then also news from the planet Mars. The Mars rover, after many a years trekking across 13 miles of Martian desert, has finally reached the peak of the Endeavour crater. And then we're going to bring on two special guests today. We're going to talk about an optimistic point of view about the future, and then what a catastrophic future could look like if all of a sudden we have to, quote, power down and reduce our consumption levels, in fact, maybe even reduce the population of the planet Earth. We have two special guests today. The first is Professor Richard Heinberg, author of the book Power Down. And then we have Eric Asadorian of the World Watch Institute, giving us a sum up of where the Earth is today. Well, let's just jump right into the top stories of the past week. The first story concerns a gigantic plastic tent being built over Unit 1 at the disastrous Fukushima nuclear site in northern Japan. It turns out that this airtight polyester wrap will stand 177 feet tall and stretch 154 feet in length, and it is held up by a metal frame. Work on this gigantic plastic tent began just this week on Unit 1, and if successful, it will be extended to Units 2 and Units 3, which suffered the most damage, in fact, a 100% core melt at Units 1, 2, and 3. As a consequence, radiation continues to be spewed out of the reactor every single day of the week. Because the melted core has penetrated parts of the containment structure and is in contact with cooling water, it means that radiation is continuing to flow into the atmosphere where it gets into agricultural products. Beef, vegetables, tea, seafood have been contaminated by the radiation from that site. Also, good news from the planet Mars. It turns out that the Mars rovers, which landed on Mars in 2004, which had an expected lifetime of just 3 months, have since chugged on till 2011, 7 years later. And now Opportunity, the one rover that is still functioning, has reached the top of the Endeavour crater. It is now king of the hill. And it made that 13-mile trek across the Martian desert, taking over 3 years to do it. The purpose of this latest mission is to analyze the clay inside the Endeavour crater. Craters are caused by asteroid and meteor impacts, which are like time machines. They reveal layers of rock laid down billions of years ago. And also, at some point in the future, Mars was once rainy and tropical, and these craters were once upon a time filled with water. Well, now let's begin by bringing on our two special guests today. In my book, Physics of the Future, I give a rather optimistic assessment of where science, technology, computers, robots, and medicine are going into the coming decades. My book, Physics of the Future, was a New York Times bestseller this year, and it was based on interviews I've conducted with over 300 of the world's top scientists concerning the future, and these interviews were done for BBC Television, the Discovery Channel, the Science Channel, and of course, Exploration, giving you perhaps the most realistic look at the coming decades. But what happens in a worst-case scenario? What happens when all hell breaks loose? What happens when we suffer economic collapse? That's the frightening scenario laid out by Professor Richard Heinberg, and his latest book is called Power Down, giving us a chilling preview of what might happen if a worst-case scenario then begins to unfold. And then we're going to bring on Eric Asadorian of the Worldwise Institute, who will give us a state of the planet, giving us an understanding of where we are on the planet Earth today. So we have two special guests today on Exploration talking about the future of the world, the future of the economy, and the future of the environment. The first question for you, Professor Heinberg, is, you make a claim that there's a relationship between the rise of big oil and the decline of public transportation. Could you elaborate?
The U.S. used to have good public transportation, good trolley lines in every city and so on, a good train system. But then throughout the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, General Motors and Firestone and Standard Oil of California conspired to buy up all of the public transportation systems in cities and towns across the U.S. and destroy them so that Americans literally would have no choice but to own cars. So the creation of the suburbs was partly happenstance and partly a deliberate design to create a way of life that was entirely automobile dependent and that therefore would use more and more oil and tires and cars and buses and so on.
And in the middle of all this, as we are rolling in cheap oil, there's something called Hubbert's Peak, proposed by a petrochemical engineer. Many people laughed at Hubbert's Peak. And, Mr. Hubbert got the last laugh, because that is exactly what happened to U.S. oil production in the late 60s and 70s. So could you elaborate on what is this Hubbert's Peak?
Right. Well, Marion King Hubbert was probably the preeminent petroleum geologist of the 20th century. He worked for Shell Research Labs. He also taught at MIT and UCLA and a number of other schools. He had many accomplishments to his name as a geologist and geophysicist. But then in the late 1950s, actually in 1956 to be precise, he predicted that United States oil production would peak around 1970. And he was roundly criticized and laughed at for saying this because at that time, of course, the U.S. was still by far the world's foremost oil-producing nation, and no one saw an end in sight. But what he had done was through his field research working for the oil companies, he had found that for every oil-producing region or any oil well, for that matter, there tended to be a kind of natural bell-shaped curve of production activity, so that when about half the resource had been extracted, the production tended to peak and decline from then on. Well, he knew that in the United States, discoveries of oil had peaked back in the early 1930s and had been falling off ever since then. So using that information, he was able to extrapolate about how much oil was in place in the U.S. to start with before we started drilling and extracting oil. And once he had that extrapolated figure, then he could figure out when we would have gotten to about the halfway mark. And that was about 1970, and he turned out to be exactly right. U.S. oil production did peak in 1970-71. And in my view and that of many others, this really deserves to be considered the most important economic event of the 20th century, at least for the United States. Because everything really has changed for us since then. We've become more and more dependent on oil imports. Our foreign policy has changed. It's affected us economically and so on.
And now let's talk about a Hubbert's Peak for world oil supply.
Since the United States peaked in oil production, country after country has done the same thing. There are about 45 significant oil-producing countries in the world, and at least 18 and possibly up to 24 of those have peaked. For example, Indonesia, extremely important oil-exporting country throughout the 20th century. In many ways, the Eastern Pacific sphere of battle in World War II centered on the Dutch East Indies because Japan has no indigenous oil supplies. It needed oil, and the Dutch East Indies was the biggest oil supplier in the entire Pacific region. So and also Shell started out in Dutch East Indies and so on. So this Indonesia has been extraordinarily important as an oil exporter. Well, Indonesia is in deep decline in terms of its oil production, and this year Indonesia will actually import more oil than it exports. Same with Great Britain, which benefited so much from the oil discoveries in the North Sea in the 1960s and 70s. This year, Great Britain will import more oil than it exports. So every year we're seeing another country jump from the column of oil exporters to the column of oil importers. Moreover, we are seeing depletion take a big bite out of oil production capacity every year. The world produces and uses about 83 or 84 million barrels of oil per day right now. That's our current production capacity. We know, for example, this year that Indonesia will produce less oil than it did last year. Same with Oman. Mexico will probably produce less oil this year than it did last year. Mexico is peaking just this year. So some other countries have to make up the difference. They have to produce more oil this year than they did last year, and it amounts to about 4 million barrels a day of new production capacity needed, plus another 1.5 million to 2 million per day to make up for new demand from places like China. So that's a total of about 6 million barrels a day of new production capacity needed every year, and it's gradually growing because depletion is taking bigger and bigger bite. So that by the end of this decade, we'll need on the order of 30 to 35 million barrels per day of new production capacity. Now, is there that much new production capacity in development? Turns out, no. A very good study on this was done by Chris Skrobosky, who's the editor of Petroleum Review in London. The study was called Oil Field Mega Projects, and he was able to calculate, and it actually wasn't that complicated because the oil companies and the oil-producing countries tell us all the time what new production projects they have coming online. And there are no real surprises that are likely before the end of the decade because all of these projects take years to develop. So he was able to calculate that by 2010, only about 12.5 million barrels a day of new production capacity is going to come online. That's certainly not going to be enough to meet the demand. And so between now and the end of the decade, we will see the all-time oil production peak, most likely in the year 2007.
And some people say that we would have to discover a new Saudi Arabia, perhaps every 10 years, just to keep up with rising consumption of oil on the planet, especially with China and India coming up. And that's simply not going to happen, say most people, right?
That's right. In fact, the United States Geological Survey produced a report back in 1999 called World Petroleum Assessment 2000, in which they extrapolated that global oil production would not peak until something like 2020 to 2035. And they based that on the assumption that discoveries of oil going forward would be extremely robust. We should be, according to USGS, discovering something on the order of 20 to 40 billion barrels of oil every year in order to reach that result. But in fact, we're only discovering about 10 billion barrels of oil every year. Global oil discoveries peaked in the early 1960s and have been going downhill ever since. The situation has gotten so bad that within the last two or three years, the global oil industry has invested about $8 billion per year in exploration, but they've only found about $4 billion worth of oil in each typical year.
Okay, now your book is different from other books in the sense that you say that even alternative energy sources, well, they're not as good as they're cranked up to be, and we may be facing a mix of different kinds of energy sources in the future. But let me just take on a few of them where you actually differ with some other environmentalists. Let's take the issue of hydrogen power. Some environmentalists like Jeremy Rifkin, Amy Lovins, look very favorably on hydrogen power. And you say, well, there's another point of view. Could you elaborate?
Well, there are a number of studies of hydrogen that have come out with very critical outcomes. Of course, hydrogen is not a real energy source in and of itself because it takes energy to produce hydrogen. Currently, almost all of the commercially produced hydrogen is simply made out of fossil fuels, mostly natural gas. Hydrogen, of course, can be made from water through electrolysis, but then, of course, that takes a lot of electricity. So if we were going to make enough hydrogen to run the 200 million car fleet of the U.S., we would need an extraordinary amount of the stuff, which would require us to increase our electricity production by almost an order of magnitude. So that's not likely to happen anytime soon. I do think we should be putting more research into hydrogen. I think we should develop hydrogen vehicles for emergency purposes. But the idea that we can run our personal automobiles on hydrogen, I think, is a pipe dream, certainly over the short term and probably altogether.
And some environmentalists are splitting with other environmentalists, saying that perhaps nuclear power is the way to go because the greenhouse effect is simply too horrible to contemplate. So do you think that putting uranium in your gas tank is going to be the solution to the problem?
No, I don't. Now, of course, nuclear power is a source of electricity, and over the short term, if in fact we are facing a global oil production peak within the next 2 to 5 years, simply having more electricity will not help that much because we don't have 200 million electric cars in this country. The problem is a shortfall of liquid transportation fuels, not electricity. So over the short term, more nuclear reactors won't help at all anyway. And then, of course, there are tremendous problems with nuclear energy, simply the cost factor. If you fully cost nuclear power with the design and building of the nuclear plants, the lifetime cycle, the storage of nuclear waste, and then the decommissioning of nuclear plants, it turns out that nuclear power is quite expensive. It's not if you just take into account the actual operating cost of nuclear plants. In that case, it's inexpensive. Then the new generation of nuclear plants, the pebble bed nuclear reactors that so much hope is being placed in, are still an unknown factor. South Africa is building one, but I was just in South Africa recently and asked their energy ministry how it was going, and I was told that it will be producing commercial power hopefully by 2015. So that's the very first prototype model. It will take many years after that before we could build similar reactors here in the U.S. So nuclear power, even if we take a favorable view of it for environmental reasons, which I think is doubtful for many reasons because of the problem of nuclear waste storage and so on, even if we do take a favorable view of it from an environmental point of view, it's still not a very practical option from the standpoint of the amount of lead time and the amount of investment required.
Okay, and also in your book, you take on other so-called magic bullets, showing that they're not as good as they're cranked up to be. But moving on, your book is also controversial because you paint a worst-case scenario, and it is a worst-case scenario. Now, we're not talking about the most likely scenario. But a worst-case scenario for energy collapse is quite horrendous. Let me just summarize page 149 of your book. You talk about power blackouts, general chaos, food production plummets, food riots, civil wars raging, water shortages, rising sea levels, severe storms wreaking further havoc. Not to mention the fact that one after the other, central governments begin to collapse in a worst-case scenario. Societies attempt to shed complexity in stages, but then they begin to devolve. Empires devolve into nations. Nations devolve into smaller regional or tribal states. And between 2020 and 2100, the global population declines perhaps to fewer than 1 billion from the 6 billion plus that we have right now. Survivors' grandchildren are entertained by stories of a great civilization of the recent past, in which people flew in metal birds and got everything they wanted by pressing buttons. So you paint a situation where civilization itself begins to collapse. Could you elaborate on that worst-case scenario?
Right. Well, social complexity has to be funded by energy. It's impossible to build up social complexity if you don't have spare energy to do it with. And so if we are going to have less energy available on a per capita basis in the future, as it looks like we will as we run out of fossil fuels, because after all, fossil fuels were just a one-time gift from nature And before fossil fuels, we were living in a pre-industrial way of life using the yearly solar input budget. And it's only because of this one-time gift that we've been able to build up this level of social complexity and size of population and so on. Given that fact, as fossil fuels go away, it looks likely that that we will see a reduction in social complexity. Now, that's a kind of sterile phrase, but what it actually means on the ground is that we'll have trouble feeding ourselves and we'll have trouble keeping the same level of communications and transportation systems that we have today. And with all of that, what that implies, I mean, how will we keep an airline industry going if we don't have kerosene to burn in jet engines? How will we be able to feed ourselves if industrial agriculture, which depends so much on diesel fuel to run tractors and combines and seeders and fuel for transportation of food and for the packaging and processing of food, how will we feed ourselves if we have less oil to do that with? These are very serious problems, and in a worst-case scenario, we could see literally a collapse of industrial civilization. And in fact, there has been a book published just recently by Jared Diamond called Collapse, which I think, in fact, makes a rather weak case for the imminent collapse of industrial civilization, because he doesn't even take into account the likely peak of oil production in the near term.
And we've had Jared Diamond on the radio show talking about these matters. But your scenario is quite more elaborate than other people's disaster scenarios. The population of the Earth right now is about 6.5 billion people. You're talking about devolving down to 1 billion, which means that if you look around, 5 out of 6 people are not going to make it. Most central governments won't make it. So you're pretty serious about this, right?
Well, as you say, this is the worst-case scenario, and things certainly could turn out that way. I earnestly hope that they won't, and I think that there are many things we could do to result in a much better outcome. But I think if we do nothing, if we simply let the forces that are in play work themselves out, the likelihood is that we will see a century of resource wars. And, of course, the weapons that we have available these days are horrendous in their destructive effect. And we will also see collapsing governments, collapsing environment, and collapsing population.
Okay. Well, let's now talk about a possible positive program. You paint a dire picture, and, again, it is a worst-case scenario. No one is saying that that is actually going to happen, but it's a pretty horrific worst-case scenario. But you talk about power down. First of all, define what is the word power down, and how do you see that taking effect, given the fact that the nations of the world right now are pretty much doing nothing?
Right. Well, if we're going to find our way down the fossil fuel peak, down the mountain, we're going to have to do it in a cooperative and coordinated way. And that means literally kicking the fossil fuel habit. We are, in many respects, fossil fuel addicts, and I don't mean that only personally. It's personally true of each of us, myself included, but it's also true of our society as a whole. And reforming ourselves, getting off this addiction, is going to be something like going through a 12-step program. We're going to have to reduce the amount of oil that is imported in every importing country and reduce the amount of oil that's being extracted and exported for every oil exporting country. Now, this could be done with a kind of global oil depletion protocol in which there would be an agreement simply to do exactly these things. And I think actually a very good case can be made for this global oil production protocol or global oil depletion protocol, because if you think about it, it's in all of our interests to do this. If we don't, it's going to be extremely difficult for everyone. There's a recent report, by the way, that I should mention, that was commissioned by the U.S. Department of Energy from Science Applications International Corporation. The U.S. Department of Energy basically asked the question, is global oil peak real, and if so, what should we do about it? very serious, and the longer we wait to undertake mitigation projects, the worse it will be. If we start 20 years ahead of time, we'll be much better off. If we start 10 years ahead of time, not so good. If we wait until the event itself, then things will be extremely chaotic. So we know from the SAIC report that it's in everyone's interest, in fact, to kick the fossil fuel habit earlier rather than later. This is not just a matter of ethical response to the problem of global climate change that may affect people who live on islands somewhere. This is a matter of the economic survival of our own nation. The sooner we get off oil, the better off we will be. So every country that signs on to the oil depletion protocol benefits from it.
Now, in your book, you also talk about decreasing energy consumption per capita. Now, that may sound like nice words, but you also use the example of the Amish people. They, of course, use much less energy per capita than the rest of us. But Americans are, of course, gas guzzlers. We're pill poppers. We want instant gratification. We have the me generation. And when you mention the Amish, are you exaggerating? You're using this for shock value? Or do you really think that that's the way of the future?
Well, I think the Amish are survivors. They have very little change to their lifestyle that will be required as fossil fuels decline. I don't think we will all necessarily be living exactly like the Amish 100 years from now, but certainly we will be living with much less oil per capita. And I think the way we will have to get there is through some form of rationing, just as we'll need a kind of international rationing regime to stabilize oil prices and to prevent competition and resource wars. I think on the national level, we'll need a kind of rationing scheme. And something like this has been worked out by some British economists. It's called domestic tradable quotas, and you can look this up on the Internet, dtqs.org, and see what they have in mind. I think that's probably the most rational system for reducing on a yearly basis the amount of oil that we'll have. And then because these rations will be tradable, people who are very careful about their energy usage and use less will have surplus rations that they can sell. And then people who insist on driving SUVs and guzzling their energy will have to pay a lot extra in order to do that.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, our first special guest has been Richard Heinberg. He's the author of a new book called Power Down, about the potential environmental collapse that could take place if we continue to consume oil at the rate we do, oil supplies run out, and the greenhouse effect kicks in. And in the second half of Exploration, we're going to be bringing on Eric Asadorian. He's a staff scientist at the World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C., which is the world's premier think tank for environmental information concerning the state of the planet. So once again, the special theme of today's program is the environment and the possibility of an environmental collapse. And once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. So stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began an interview, a pre-recorded interview, with Professor Richard Heinberg, author of a new book called Power Down, talking about the collapse of civilization itself, unless we do something about it now. What happens when food riots break out? National borders begin to disintegrate? When starvation stalks the land? When millions of people begin to perish because we did not lay the groundwork for a green economy? Well, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to continue our discussion with Professor Heinberg, and then we're going to bring on Eric Asadorian of the World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C. They published the State of the World Report concerning the state of the planet. And the question is, are we nearing the point of no return that Richard Heinberg mentioned in the first part of this program? Now, the Chinese people and the Indian people, they see Hollywood movies. They see the lifestyle of people in Los Angeles. They want a good life. They want McDonald's hamburgers and the kind of rather wasteful lifestyle of most self-indulgent Americans. And are you going to tell them that, hey, wait a minute, the West, we had this great lifestyle, but you're too late. There's not enough energy for you guys. You guys are going to have to have a very poor lifestyle in the future. What's to prevent them from being very resentful about that?
Well, I think they probably will be, and there's no remedy for that. However, the situation is as it is. There's only so much oil in the ground, and we've burned about half of it so far. So there's going to be less and less to go around no matter what we do. Now, some people, I think, will criticize the oil depletion protocol because it doesn't make any take account of energy equity. It doesn't say that as rich nations use less, there should be more available for the poorer nations. And actually, I've thought about this a great deal, and I think actually that, in fact, oil has been poison for all of us, for every nation in the world, and every nation that's gotten addicted to it, even though it's enjoyed some short-term benefits, the fast-paced lifestyle and easy transportation and so on. In the long term, we're going to have to pay for that very, very dearly. So for poorer nations to have a larger fossil fuel ration would simply mean they would have the opportunity to become more addicted to the stuff. They would be able to build more highways, buy more cars, and so on, and then a few years down the line, that would be a millstone around their necks. So the sooner every nation can kick the fossil fuel habit, the better off it will be for that nation.
Now, you also say things in your book that are not said in other books, and that is there is a small split within the movement between the more civil rights, civil liberties people that want to increase personal freedom and personal choice versus environmentalists who are concerned about the world population, the consumption of resources, and the carrying capacity of the earth, and that there is a potential conflict there. A conflict over, well, how many kids you're going to have? What will be the population of the earth? Will coercion have to be used as the population spirals out of control? What are your thoughts?
Well, this is a very, very difficult question. And I, every time I bring it up in a public lecture, it always leads to some discussion. Because, well, on one hand, I myself am politically pretty much of an anarchist. I really dislike the idea of big government and government controls and so on. But the fact is, if we are going to cooperatively find our way off this very shaky ecological limb that we've moved out onto over the last 150 years, we are going to have to cooperatively reduce the size of our human population because we are relying on what could be called phantom carrying capacity right now. In other words, we don't have 6.5 billion people because the Earth can sustainably support that many people. We have 6.5 billion people, only because we have a temporary gift of fossil fuels that enable us to grow so much more food and transport it from places where resources are abundant to where they're scarce, cheaply and on a large scale. So as those cheap fuels go away, we're going to be able to support fewer and fewer people. Now, nature will take care of the problem. solution. We'd rather see a more peaceful ending to the story. I think we're going to have to find ways to humanely and cooperatively and democratically reduce the size of the human population. And that means also in places like North America. I'm not simply talking about India and China. And however, in those places, I think people on the ground in those countries are keenly aware that population is a serious issue, and they're already trying to do something about it. But here in North America, I think population, overpopulation is a function not just of raw numbers, but also it's a raw numbers times the per capita rate of consumption. So we're going to have to reduce our per capita rate of consumption and our population in this country. And how we do that? Well, I think we could provide economic incentives for families to have fewer children. Certainly, raising the educational levels and the economic power of women in poorer societies has always been proven to lower fertility rates. We're going to have to do basically everything we can.
Now, Malthus, centuries ago, said that populations, if they outrace their ability to feed those populations, eventually face violent collapse. But then, of course, we had a great expansion of agriculture over the last few hundred years. Then in the 60s, people talked about a population bomb, that we're all going to die because we're all going to overpopulate ourselves and there's not enough food left. But then we had the so-called Green Revolution. Now, people, well, what do you think about whether or not the Malthusian predictions ultimately could come to be?
Right. Well, I don't think I would have found many places of agreement with Malthus as a human being if he were alive today. But he was very conservative politically and in some ways not a very nice person, I think. But his basic insight about population, I think, was basically essentially true. And we have avoided the population collapse, as you say, through a number of means, mostly having to do with fossil fuels and new crop varieties and so on. But we've just about run through that all of those strategies. Today we're losing topsoil, we're losing arable land, we're facing freshwater shortages. And in fact, we've already peaked in per capita grain production. In other words, for the past number of years, we've actually been producing less grain per capita with each passing year. So it's only a matter of time before we run through the remaining stocks of stored surplus grain, and we begin experiencing actual shortfalls on a yearly basis. And this could happen within literally just 3 or 4 years. Lester Brown is projecting that just within the next few years, China will be able to soak up all of the world's food exports. These days, the U.S. has become a net food importer on a dollar basis, not in terms of actual amounts of food, but on a dollar basis, we're importing more food than we export. So a lot of long-term trends that looked pretty rosy have shifted in recent years, and our ability to continue to feed 6.5 billion people, I think, is really up for question.
And that concludes our interview with Dr. Richard Heinberg. He's the author of the new book, Power Down, talking about what happens when all hell breaks loose, when oil runs out, the greenhouse effect goes amok, and nations begin to collapse. Well, let's now talk about the situation today, not the situation 20, 30 years from now, but the situation on the ground today. And is it too late to make changes? Our first guest today is Eric Asadorian. He's a staff scientist at the World Watch Institute, which monitors the state of the planet. And in light of 9/11, many people say that the environmental movement has to readjust a bit. And so we're going to talk to him about security issues, population issues, and the pressure on resources on this planet. Okay, and in your State of the World, you have a whole chapter devoted to population and security. So could you be specific about what population pressures engender security concerns? And first of all, what is the population of the Earth? How fast is it growing? And what is the link between population and security?
Okay, let me answer the easy questions first. Right now, our population is about 6.3 billion. And we, in the United Nations, estimates that it'll peak at about 8.9 billion people and around 2050. So, of course, with our growing consumption levels and our growing populations, this alone is putting more and more pressure on the environment, and this could in itself be a security concern. But then you couple that with issues like increasing youth populations. Today, over 138 countries, in 138 countries, youth populations actually make up more than 40% of the population. Combine this with increasing youth unemployment rates, and you have kind of a recipe for instability. More and more young people are out of work, they are facing increased poverty, and this kind of creates a ripe kind of population to kind of recruit into globalized crime organizations, into terrorist organizations, into local militias, which can in turn destabilize local countries, regions, or even lead to terrorist attacks.
And some people point to the Middle East, where we have a huge population of young people, but economies which cannot absorb all these young people, leading to unemployment, alienation, and perhaps even terrorism. What are your thoughts?
Well, that we actually draw attention directly to the Middle East and Africa, where 60 million youths are out of work currently. When you have this many young people out of work and politically oppressive regimes in many countries and poor economic growth, all these together are fueling an anger and a resentment, especially when there are other military forces in occupation currently in some countries. When you have all these together, this is leading to too much anger and resentment, and this can lead to political instability.
And not to mention the fact that when people watch Hollywood movies and they see the Western lifestyle of opulence and waste, they say to themselves, well, we want that too. We want the McDonald's, we want the cars, we want the refrigerators. But can the Earth sustain, especially with China and India coming up very rapidly, can the Earth sustain that level of consumption for 6.3 billion people?
I think that the very clear and easy answer to that is no. I mean, right now, if all the world were to consume at American levels, there just wouldn't be the resources to provide for this. And this would very quickly, already we're over-consuming the natural capital that we depend on. Instead of just living in balance with the environment, there's clear indicators that suggest that we are more and more consuming the natural capital which we depend on, which is leading to increased environmental degradation. And that's only with a consumer class of about 2 billion people. But when you increase that to 6 billion or even 9 billion in the future, the Earth just couldn't handle that.
Not to mention global warming. So far, the Chinese people are right in saying that it's mainly the West, not China, that created global warming to begin with. But in the future, more and more third world countries will consume oil. And won't that, again, accelerate global warming?
Absolutely. Oil, we dedicate an entire chapter to, mainly because of the triple security threat that oil offers. First, of course, there's climate change. This alone could destabilize agriculture. It could lead to increasing ranges for specific tropical diseases, the spreading of these diseases. Climate change alone is an issue, but then you combine that with these two other threats that oil provides. One is being dependent on politically insecure areas where the majority of oil is coming from. This is increasing political instability alone, this competition between countries in need of oil. And then there's the third element, which is this economic vulnerability that pure dependence on or a high level of dependence on oil. Right now, actually 33 of the 48 largest oil producers, their production is either peaking or in decline already. And yet you have more and more demand, or demand is increasing further when China and India, two very large countries growing quickly, are looking for more and more oil. So this is putting more and more pressure on the demand side, and supply is peaking and slowly declining.
Now, there is something called Hubbert's Peak, and we've had people on the show talking about Hubbert's Peak, but there is a bell-shaped curve a bell-shaped curve of the amount of oil that we can take out of the Earth. And some people say we're right at the top of the bell-shaped curve, and we can only go down from now. And that could cause massive global disruption into the coming years and decades. What are your thoughts?
Well, it could. The question is, where are we on that curve? And I would say, you know, no one is very clear on whether we're at the very peak or if we're, just peaking. But we are close. I mean, it seems that looking at the trends that we have probably 20 to 40 years at the very most. That's the kind of moderate conservative analysis. But we have a limited amount of time, a generation at the most, to make an intentional transition to a different fuel source. If we, start acting now and start moving towards renewable energy, energy that's not polluting and also is easily produced by countries themselves, like wind power, like biofuels, and that we don't have to depend on politically instable areas of the world to get them, this could, if it's done slowly and methodically, we could actually increase our economic benefits and increase our global security. But at the same time, if we don't and we allow our dependence on oil to collapse when the oil supply collapses and not having made precautions, this could really lead us to increasing insecurity, perhaps wars over oil, or at least some political instabilities that we should avoid.
And speaking about oil and energy, what about renewables? Europe is getting more and more into wind power and diversifying. How does the energy output and outlook look like for the world right now?
Well, renewables is a very small percentage of total energy production, but that is partly because of the lack of commitment towards pushing these energy. Of course, we cannot expect to have switch within 5 years to 100% renewables. That's absurd, and there will always be small amounts of probably fossil fuels being used for many, many years to come. But if we, again, methodically make this transition, prioritize it, encourage this through the subsidies or at least the actual proper costing, creating the actual factoring in external costs into fossil fuels like the climate change and making sure that we recognize that these fuels have their side effects, this can make a more level playing field for the production of renewable energies. So by doing this, we can actually have that double benefit of increasing security, creating a new industry, so a triple benefit, and, of course, increasing environmental well-being.
Well, what about nuclear energy? China seems to be flirting with nuclear energy right now, which, of course, raises security concerns in and of itself. Look at the Iranian situation right now. But what are your thoughts about the fortunes of nuclear energy?
I actually am very against nuclear energy. There's some strong reasons for that, primarily with the amount it takes to create a new nuclear power plant. You can create more wind power with the same kind of investment per dollar. You're going to receive more megawatts in by using wind turbines, as well as you produce more jobs as you produce wind power. So for simple economic reasons, it's better to produce wind power instead of nuclear power. But then you combine the security implications of more nuclear energy, not just the short-term question of not only are they dangerous if an accident occurs, like in Chernobyl, for example, but they are very weakly guarded right now. Even Greenpeace has shown several times they've invaded, in essence, a nuclear power plant, once in the United Kingdom, once in France, and they were successfully able to take over the nuclear power plant and raise banners on the reactors. Of course, fortunately, they were only trying to do this as a demonstration to show how vulnerable nuclear power plants are. But if it was a terrorist organization that did this instead, we could have had a new disaster on the size of Chernobyl. So just for the insecurity issue in the short term, that alone should really make it questionable source of power, nuclear energy. But then you add the also, of course, the long-term question of what to do with waste that is that lasts is more is toxic for longer than human civilization has even existed. That also should raise red flags that whether this is a viable source of energy.
Well, the Bush administration, in its earlier energy policy, put nuclear energy right at the centerpiece, trying to revive the fortunes of this fading technology with the infusion of subsidies and generation of gas-cooled reactors. What's the status with regards to whether or not George W. Bush has been able to revive the fortunes of commercial nuclear energy?
Well, right now, nothing has moved forward, although with four more years to play with, they might have, continue to push for more nuclear energy. And I think I'm nervous that they'll push it forward because it does offer a diversification of our energy sources. Of course, saying that we want to get away from oil, the immediate reaction is sometimes, well, let's build more nuclear power plants. However, as I mentioned, it's a much smarter investment on many levels to and take that same money and invest in wind power and solar technologies and biofuels, because these are safer. They're things that we can produce locally, and they just are much less of a security threat than nuclear power would be.
And solar energy, it's always been on the horizon. It's within striking distance of becoming economical, but it's still more expensive than oil or coal. What do you foresee about the fortunes of solar electricity, given the fact that we have to perhaps jumpstart it, perhaps mass produce it? But what about the fortunes in terms of economy?
Well, I think you're right. We have to jumpstart it. If we continue along and just ignore it and hope that it magically becomes a viable energy source, it'll always kind of remain on the fringes. But if we actually intentionally invest in the research, we will be able to make it a much more economical source. Already in some areas where there's high levels of sun, it can be economical. And again, it avoids security questions. When you have solar cells on the rooftop producing energy, this is not, this is not a dangerous source of energy. It doesn't there's no pipelines to destroy. There's no reactors that are vulnerable. So you have this kind of other benefit that we're not paying attention, as well as, of course, the environmental benefit. It's not producing climate-changing gases. So these combined with the economic realities of a declining oil source and increasing prices, this will probably, hopefully, make it a viable choice.
And switching gears a little bit, let's talk about food. You have a whole chapter about food and security in State of the World 2005. So first of all, tell us a little bit about food harvests, grain harvests and fish harvests. I understand that they are peaking in some sense.
In some areas, especially, China is one of the most well-known examples where their grain harvests have declined. And primarily that's because of reappropriation of land, the building of new roads and cities. These are taking away from cropland. However, I think what we tried to bring attention to in this chapter were not the traditional food insecurity questions of hunger and malnutrition. Those are well documented and well known, but draw attention to new food security threats. For example, this loss of diversity of plant and animal species. The more we use a kind of monocropping agro-business kind of technology, this kind of direction, we are losing more and more of our plant diversity. And this could be a threat in cases that, a new virus or fungus arises and destroys one type of corn, for example. If this happened, when we're so dependent on just a few types, we could have a major new famine. Also, climate change, as I mentioned earlier, this could disrupt agriculture significantly, where, just a slight change in temperature could change harvest and growing seasons, and this could lead to a major decline in agricultural production. So these are dangers that we're not really addressing as directly when we think about food security, but we wanted to draw attention to.
Now, of course, it was Malthus a few centuries ago who pointed out that if population outraces food supply, then you're going to have famine, and that will check your population growth. Well, those dire predictions never turned out to be true because of the Green Revolution, because of efficiency, because of greater harvesting of crops and modern technology. But how long can that go? Some people say that we're beginning to hit the peak in terms of fish harvest, we're cleaning out the oceans, and in terms of grain harvest. But what are your thoughts?
Well, I hope that we will never reach that point, honestly. I mean, I hope that we figure out a way to balance our food supplies with our population. However, at the same time, as we've already discussed, we have an increasing population that might rise to 9 billion, and yet soil erosion continues every year to be an increasing concern. Fishery harvests are peaking in many areas or declining in many others. When we have all these pressures that we see around us, I'm personally very concerned that we are reaching a point where, as you mentioned, a peak of our food production.
And that concludes our interview with Eric Asadorian, staff scientist at the World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C., perhaps the world's leading think tank monitoring the state of the planet. And earlier, our special guest was Richard Heinberg, and he's a professor and also author of the book Power Down, about the worst-case scenario, and that involves the collapse of the world economy itself because the pressures from the global crisis and the energy crisis. Now, personally, I'd like to say that I don't believe that we have hit the point of no return. In fact, I think there are several points of no return, some of which we've already hit. For example, I think it's really too late to save the polar ice sheet. I think many climatologists believe that it's a foregone conclusion that sometime late in the 21st century, we will lose the North Polar ice sheet no matter what we do at the present time, because so much carbon dioxide has been lofted into the atmosphere up to now. However, I don't think we've hit the point of no return with regards to a collapse of Western civilization as a whole. And that's why I think that President Barack Obama has a great opportunity to marshal all the intellectual and economic and financial resources that he can to fight the global crisis and then to solve the energy crisis and to solve the whole question of global warming. It's not too late. However, I think time is running out, and as Professor Heinberg and Eric Asadorian pointed out, if we dilly-dally, we will miss this opportunity. And perhaps our children and grandchildren will wonder, why did we botch it so badly? Why did we mismanage the stewardship of our planet, endangering all life on the planet? So once again, I don't think that we have hit the final point of no return. I think there is time, especially if President Barack Obama can summon all the resources at his disposal to reverse the current crises. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our first guest was Professor Richard Heinberg, author of Power Down. Our second guest was Eric Asadorian of the World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. And also check out my website. It's mkaku.org, mkaku.org. And there are quite a few links on the website concerning my latest book, Physics of the Impossible, which is now on the New York Times bestseller list, and which my publisher has agreed to generously donate to make sure that your local public and community radio stations are alive, well, and healthy. Once again, this is Professor Michio Kaku for Exploration.